Happy New Year, everyone, and welcome to the Condensed Matter Review course for Psi. I have taught this course for 5 years before, and then last year I couldn't come, so I'm coming back now, and hopefully it will go well. And okay, so what is this course about? So this course is about two things. The first thing is to understand some modern concepts in theoretical condensed matter. And we will focus a lot on concepts like quantum phase transitions, correlation functions, quantum correlations, and notions like the concept of a quantum phase, quantum matter, exotic quantum matters, and things like that. The second goal of this course is to present you with some technical tools that are actually necessary for every theoretical physicist. So we will be studying, in particular, how to solve spin chains. And quantum spin chains are one of the few theoretical models in quantum many body theories that admit an exact solution. And the knowledge of these models is important in general for quantum field theory, for high energy theory, for any theoretical physicist. At the same time, we will discuss some tools that come from quantum information theory, like von Neumann entropy, that is necessary to understand the role of quantum correlations. And together with some mathematical formulation that will help us to understand how quantum systems in general evolve in time and what are the bearings of unitarity on how quantum systems equilibrate. And all these topics, although they will be discussed in the context of some quantum many-body models that in principle should describe some class of materials, they are actually very important to understand some fundamental features of quantum mechanics. Okay, so how do we start? So the first thing that we want to start with is to understand what is a local quantum system. And why do we want to do this? Okay, so the main topic of this course is to understand quantum phases and so in general, what is a phase? Okay, so you're not familiar yet with the concept of quantum phases, but probably many of you have already taken some class in statistical mechanics. So you know, you have encountered this notion of what is a phase. Okay, so is there anyone who wants to try to say what is a phase in statistical mechanics? Do not be shy. Yes, please.
Well, we talked about magnets and talked about order parameters and describe a different phase. So order of spins is, if it's highly ordered, it's a ferromagnet, low order.
Yes, so these are examples of phases. Yeah. But so if I give you an atom, okay, or a molecule, or one electron? Can I talk about the phases of an electron? So the phase is the property of what? Of a many-body system, when this many is very large. And what kind of property is it? So if I am, if I present you with a piece of iron, okay, you say, oh, this is iron, right? And then I give you another sample of iron, and you say, oh, this is also iron. However, they are very different, right? They may have a different masses to start with. They can be at different temperatures. Their Hamiltonian can be different because if I give you an actual sample of iron, the crystalline structure of iron has defects, and they are not the same in the two samples. So they would have a different geometric dislocation of the atoms and the molecules, and also there would be other impurities, like other atoms, but they're still iron. Okay, so they are not the same, but they are the same. Right? So when is that we say that some things that are not the same are the same? Because we identify something that is important. Okay, so they are the same in what is important, and they're not the same in what doesn't matter. So this is what a phase is. So we need to recognize what is important in a system of many particles. And what is important will turn out to be correlations. Okay, so we have an extended system made of many particles, of many bodies. And there will be things called correlations that relate different parts of the system. So these two parts can be correlated, or these two parts can be correlated. So you see that all that we are really interested in is the relationship between what is correlated in the neighborhood of a subsystem, or what is correlated at long distance. So in order to talk about extended systems, for the very fact that they're extended, we need to imagine them as composite, right? So they must be composite of many parts. And these many parts are in some sense local. So that it does make sense to say too far apart parts of the system are correlated, and then we have something called the long range order, or they are not. So all, in fact, all statistical mechanics comes from the interplay between what is local and what is not local. So for this reason, our first notion that we need to explain is what is a local quantum system. Okay, so first of all, before saying when it is local, what is a quantum system? Okay. So a quantum system is a Hilbert space together with a Hamiltonian. And we use H, unfortunately, for both words, because the family names of these people are all with H, but so calligraphic H will be the Hilbert space and capital H will be the Hamiltonian. And usually you are presented, you know, in literature, okay, let's study this given quantum system, and they give you the Hamiltonian. They don't give you the Hilbert space. They just give you the Hamiltonian. And pretty much when you have some experience, you know, it's just boring to tell you also what is the Hilbert space because it's obvious. However, one has to be careful because sometimes it's not very obvious. Okay. So let me give you an example. This example will be used again in a few lectures when we'll talk about gauge theories. Okay, so imagine that we have the Hilbert space of a particle on a straight line. Okay, so we can describe this Hilbert space by some basis vectors that we can call ket x, where x is a real number. Right? So we could say that this set is a basis for this Hilbert space. Okay? And now I can give you some Hamiltonian for this Hilbert space. For instance, I can say that this Hamiltonian is p squared over 2m plus some potential that is some constant, and then cosine something. Okay, so this is a decent Hamiltonian for this Hilbert space. However, this Hamiltonian has some interesting feature. And it tells us that the potential here at x, at the potential at x plus 2 pi a, is the same. Okay?
X plus a? X plus a?
Oh, yeah. X plus a. Okay, no big deal. We are in presence of a periodic potential. So how do we call this thing? Usually we use a fancy word for this. This is a symmetry of the Hamiltonian. Right? The energy here is the same as the energy here. Why we do not immediately recognize it as a symmetry is because we like to associate symmetries to operators. In this case, we can define the translation operator ty that to x associates x plus y. And now you see that TA is the operator that transforms this ket, the ket that describes the particle at this point, to the ket of the particle at this point. And then you can see that these two operators commute. This is what you like to call a symmetry of the Hamiltonian. Or in other words, that the energy in this state has the same expectation value than in this state, well, when y is equal to a. OK, so this is a symmetry. But now imagine that I want to describe a particle on a circle of length a. Okay, so this length is a. So what is the Hilbert space for this situation? Well, I still need to describe it with some labels, right? So I will have some ket x's. But these ket x's are in R mod A, right? Because this point x and this other point x plus a are the same point, are just the same point. This is how you define a circle. Circle is topologically non-trivial compared to the straight line. So in order to compactify it, you have to say x is equal to x plus a. And now I can still say, oh, this is my Hamiltonian for this other mode. Now, for a model, that describes a particle on a circle. As you can see, though, the fact that the potential is periodic, before it was a physical feature, right? It meant two different cats have the same energy. Now, it's imposed by the structure of the Hilbert space, because the particle here and the particle here again must have the same energy. In fact, the potential is not periodic. It's just imposed by the fact that this must be a Hamiltonian for this Hilbert space. So there is no symmetry of the Hamiltonian anymore. Now, because as we shall see tomorrow, symmetry is a very important concept in quantum many-body theory. It is almost all that counts. We need to be able to recognize symmetry. And therefore, we must be careful with also what the Hilbert space is. Why I'm saying all this is because some exotic models of quantum matter are based on gauge theory. And gauge theory is exactly this type of structure. You identify two states you identify two sets of labels giving you the same state. And then the Hamiltonian must respect this gauge structure. And everything, every observable of the theory must be gauge invariant, because a gauge transformation is not a transformation. It's a redundancy in the labeling of the states. So gauge symmetry, it's not a symmetry, because you are doing nothing. Okay, it's a structure that is imposed by the topology, if you wish, of the Hilbert space. Okay, so a quantum system is not just a Hamiltonian, it's Hamiltonian with the Hilbert space, because we need to be careful to these things. Okay, and so what is the Hilbert space, let's start with this, of a quantum system that wants to be a local quantum system? Well, first of all, we need to identify what is the Hilbert space of each part. So what we call the local Hilbert space will be H subscript I. So I is a label, and I runs between 1 and some number capital N. So we have many Hilbert spaces that in principle can be different, and each of them describes locally our physics. And what is the total Hilbert space? So there are many ways of making a Hilbert space out of several Hilbert spaces. But there is, let me be bold and say, there is only one way that is useful to describe correlations, and it is the tensor product. So our total Hilbert space will be the tensor product of all these local Hilbert spaces. And as you can see, if you call Qi the dimension of the ith Hilbert space, then the dimension of the total Hilbert space is the product of these dimensions. Something that we will do a lot is to not get involved in the fact that each Hilbert space is different locally. We often want to deal with a situation in which every part of the system is identical to every other part of the system. So we like to have isotropic systems, so they being they being them all the same, they have one dimension that is Q. So under this assumption that Qi is equal Q, the total dimension will be Q to the n. So this is something that you have probably already encountered if you have taken some course of quantum information or quantum foundations, that when you have a composite system, dimensions scale exponentially in the number of the bodies of your system. Very well. Okay. And because in the end, we want to talk about phases, we know from experience from statistical mechanics that all these phase properties arise when n is very large. And some of them, in fact, only arise when n goes to infinity. So the so-called thermodynamic limit. Okay, so when we want to do the thermodynamic limit, there are three important questions. First of all, what does it mean? Since no material in the world is made of n of infinite particles, right? There are 10 to the 23 or 10 to the 25, but not infinite. So when we insist that some properties only happen in the thermodynamic limit, which physically does not exist. So what do we care? So this is the first question is why? Why is it useful? And I want to know your opinion about this. So I'm sure you have already taken the thermodynamic limit many times and you have wondered the same question. So what answer did you give yourself?
Okay, imagine we have like a Ising model.
Mm-hmm.
When you simulate an Ising model, like flipping everything from up from down, like it's possible when you have large n, but the probability is really exponentially low with n, I think.
Okay.
So like even if like you have say 100 spins, you can have them all pointing up at a low temperature below the critical temperature, and then most of them pointing down if eventually in a really, really, really long time. I mean, the probability is not zero, but in the thermodynamic limit, it will never happen, right? This flipping. So maybe something like that, like.
Yes, it is something like that. So let's try to be slightly more precise about this, something like that, which is essentially what your colleague said. So expressions for large n can be very complicated, but sometimes they simplify when n goes to infinity. So for us, n to infinity is not something that happens, but it is a bookkeeping for large n behavior. So if the thermodynamic limit represents faithfully the large n behavior, then we take it. If it doesn't, we cannot take it. I mean, we could, but then it doesn't make any sense. Okay, so you have to bear this in mind because sometimes we might find weird things about the thermodynamic. So in particular, like in the example that your colleague mentioned, if the physical quantities that you are computing decay or explode like an exponential of n, so which is pretty fast in N, then the thermodynamic limit is a very faithful way of representing the asymptotic behavior for large N of your system. Then we have two other problems when we deal with the thermodynamic limit, and is, does, actually it's one problem that is declined in two subcases, does it exist? And in order to understand this question, we actually have two sub-problems. One is mathematical. And it has to do with the Hilbert space of n going to infinity particles. And the other one is physical. And it has to do with energy. Okay, can any one of you guess what are these mathematical difficulties that we might encounter in defining? Basically, we want to take the limit, capital N going to infinity, of this expression. Can you guess what could be the problem there? So how do you make a Hilbert space?
We mentioned along with the inner product definition also the completing the norm part of it.
Yes. Okay. Yes. Very good. So, very good. So, it has to do with the inner product. Everything has to do with the inner product. So, what you want a vector space on the complex numbers on which you can define an inner product. This is a Hilbert space. And in fact, when I say that the quantum system is H and H, actually, I've been sloppy because the real quantum system is not really the Hilbert space, but it's the rays in the Hilbert space, right? You only use the normalized states. However, to take the normalized states, you must start with something that is a vector space. And when you take the tensor product, well, you just take a basis in this Hilbert space by taking the tensor product of basis vectors in each Hilbert space, right? So you have basis states of this type. So when you take two such vectors, so in order to build the Hilbert space, you only need to define the inner product in basis states, right? Once you do something in a basis, then you know how to do it in the whole vector space. So all you need to do is to define this guy. And this is something like this. And so far, so good. But now, so remember, these are vectors in the vector space. They're not normalized, they're not rays. Now, obviously, when I take n going to infinity, this needs not to converge. So we have a problem. We have a problem. The mathematical solution of this problem is the following. And yeah, you can ask, why are you bothering us with all these mathematical subtleties? This is not a course in mathematical physics. But because this has an important bearing on why we need local quantum systems. So the solution is the following. We start with some reference state. Let me call it capital phi. that is indeed the tensor product. Of many of them, such that each of these states is normalized. So this is one vector, it's a reference vector. Okay, so obviously the inner product of phi with itself is fine. Now we construct what is called the for Neumann infinite tensor product of Hilbert spaces in this way, we only put as basis states, states like this, and other states that differ from this one on a finite number of indices. So this means that I take a subset of indices I such that this is a finite number. And then any state, any other basis state, will be of this form. It will be the tensor product with indices onto this finite set of some vectors. Tensor in the complement of this, that will go to infinity when we take the limit n going to infinity, these guys. So now you see that when we take the inner product between, say, this vector and this vector, or any two vectors built in this way, let me call them psi and chi, this will be equal to the tensor product, sorry, to the product on this finite set of indices of psi I, chi I, and the product on this other set of indices that is going to infinity between phi I and phi I, right? Because on this set of indices, they all look like this. Well, so you see that this converges because this is finite and this is one. So everything converges. Okay, fair enough. But this tells us something, that every operator that we can use in this Hilbert space must be such that when we use them, we don't take one of the states and get out from this set of states. So every operator must have this form. It must be some operator on a finite set of states, of indices, sorry. Tensor, the identity, so must do nothing on I bar. Of course, also sums of such operators, even if they have different support, this is called support, are fine. And products of such operators are fine, but not infinite products of such operators. So you can only take local operators and their linear combinations as you wish, and finite products of local operators. Otherwise, you don't know what the Hilbert space is. So the physical operators are local. You can still use non-local operators. Non-local operators is an operator that acts on all the indices at the same time, but they are not physical. That you use them to prove theorems. Physical operators must be local. Okay, so what is the implication? that in particular the Hamiltonian must be the sum of local operators. Okay, so how we define exactly the locality of such operators? So imagine that we have, let me call lambda the set of all the indices I. And X, capital X, is some subset. The local Hilbert space associated to this subset of indices, we will call it in this way. And it's just the tensor product of all the local Hilbert spaces with I into this subset. And a local operator is an operator A, say, that has this form. Is the complement of X. The operator is called R local if the number of indices that is inside X is upper bounded by the number capital R. Okay. So a R local quantum system is a system in which all the operators that figure in the Hamiltonian are R local in this way. Okay? So this is the first constraint that we have. We need to have locality, or we cannot talk about an extended system with infinite particles. And then there is a second problem, that it is a physical problem, has to do with energy, and you have already encountered it. So what is this problem? I'm sure some of you have taken statistical mechanics. What kind of problem is it? Imagine that we have, okay, a local system. So let's talk about classical statistical mechanics. So we do not have these problems with the Hilbert space. Can you still have the thermodynamic limit of any type of particles together? Or not? What happens if you have many, many electrons? Can you do the statistical mechanics of a system of electrons with infinite electrons?
I guess if you have infinite space to put them, then there should be no problem.
Let's see if this is true. But where should the problem arise from? I mean, so are you thinking of the radius of the electron?
If there was like an infinite density of electrons, maybe it would break down the statistical.
So infinite density, okay, densities should not be infinite. That's an important thing. What about finite density, constant density? Is that okay? So you have taken electromagnetism. We know we can have a finite density of charges on a sphere. Okay? Now, it's a finite density. The volume is, and the surface are finite. Everything is fine. Can I take this, the radius of the sphere, to infinity? Okay, let's see. Let's see if we can do that. Okay. So our potential is Coulomb, right? So it's some constant over R. Now let's take a constant density rho of charges and we put them in a sphere, so not on the surface. So it's a dielectric, if you want, okay? Not on the surface. They're everywhere. And it's a homogeneous density on a surface, on a sphere of radius r. Okay. And we want to compute the energy of this charge distribution, E of r. And then to this energy will be associated, and then to this field, there will be associated a volume, right? The volume of the sphere. And this ratio is what we call the energy density. And it goes with R. Taking the thermodynamic limit would be to take the limit of R going to infinity of this energy density. Right? What happens if this diverges? This means that even though you do not have an infinite density of electrons, you would have an infinite energy density. And also this is not physical, right? In a point of space, you cannot have infinite density. So maybe, though, you are under the impression that because this is finite, then this has to converge. Let's do that, okay? Let's do it. Okay, so let me just write this. Okay, so we use Gauss theorem, okay? So what do we have? We take all the charge that is from zero to some coordinate r, and we put it all in the center. And this is interacting with all the charge that is on the shell of radius r, right? So let's see how many charges you have up to r that we put all in the center. You have 4, 3, p, r cube, rho, right? So these are all the charges that I put in the center. Then I put the energy of interaction, and then I take all the charges on the shell, and they integrate. Okay? Well, and you see that this is 1 over v, and then we have 4 pi squared, and then we have, this u was r. Okay, then we have 15 rho squared. So we have rho to the fourth, so when I integrate, it's r phi. Okay. And then we remember that this is fine. This is 4 pi over over 3, should give me 1 here. No, gives me a 5 here, and I take this, and then I have r cube, so I get this. Okay. So you see, this is the energy density. Scales like r squared. So in the thermodynamic limit, diverges. So we cannot do the statistical mechanics of a system of electrons. The thermodynamic limit does not exist. It would result in infinite energy density. Extensive quantities. It's okay that they diverge in the thermodynamic limit. N diverges, right? V diverges, but not the density. So, but where is the catch here? So, in fact, how come matter exists? Right? Matter is made of charges, and they interact with the Coulomb potential, and then we want to take the thermodynamic limit of matter we have, so it seems I just proved that Coulomb interactions give you, in the thermodynamic limit, infinite energy density. How can matter, ordinary matter, exist? Is there some quantum thing that is lurking in here or not? You nod. It's a quantum thing. So can you tell me what, where is it, the quantum thing?
Well, you need to start talking about Pauli exclusion principle and think about...
But, okay, but... So you're saying something that is very right, but I don't understand what role plays in here, because Pauli principle is something about short distance, right? You're saying I cannot put two things too close in the same state. But so using high energy language, it's an ultraviolet problem, right? But this is an infrared problem. Right? We go at large distances and we have a problem. So whereas what you mentioned is very right and it will play a role, we'll see it in a moment, it's not this problem.
Is your potential screened? So you have a Yukawa potential?
It has to do with the potential,
yeah.
But... So, can you elaborate?
So you get electron screening.
Yes, very good, yes. So, luckily, ordinary matter is not made all of electrons. There are electrons and protons. So electrons screen the protons, and the effective potential, the Yukawa potential, is 1 over r times this is called the Debye length. And now the interesting thing is that if I put this guy in here, now you have an integral that converges when r goes to infinity. Actually, what happens is that not only converges, it converges too much. The energy, the energy density, goes like this is the, if this is the number of electrons that you have, goes like this. So this means that if we really just had the Coulomb interactions between electrons and protons, we could take the thermodynamic limit, but then everything would like to be together. Everything would collapse with each other. And this is where exclusion principle forbids you to collapse onto each other. That's where a short distance quantum mechanics plays a role. But in terms of the, you know, of having a finite energy density, is the Yukawa potential. I will distribute some notes. So you see what is the gist. This works because this falls off fast. This doesn't work because this falls off too slowly. What if we have, in general, a potential of this type in these spatial dimensions? So I will circulate nodes. You will see that you have the thermodynamic limit. So pretty much it's an exercise about integration. The thermodynamic limit exists whenever sigma is greater than d. So in three spatial dimensions, you need to have something that falls off like 1 on r to the 4. So either you have screening or gravitational potentials, Coulomb potentials, etc., do not give you statistical mechanics. So you, remember this, you cannot do statistical mechanics of a gravitational system. So this poses the problem, as we said, of the range of these interactions. So you see that now locality in our quantum system comes also in a second way, not only the support of our interactions must be limited. So how many bodies interact together? But also how far apart they are. So we need to specify the second aspect of locality. And to this end, we need to introduce some very simple notions of graph theory. Okay. So what is a graph, first of all? So we start with a set of points, and it is lambda. It's the set that contains all the indices that label your Hilbert space. So the total Hilbert space, as we said, is the tensor product of all the local Hilbert spaces over this indices lambda. Okay? But you know, when you do a so we are trying to define what is a graph. So lambda is the collection of all these points. And then when we make a graph, you usually have in mind something like this. Right? Well, we can do something more complicated than this, and it is the following. Consider the so-called power set of lambda. Power set is the set of all the subsets of lambda. Okay. All the possible ways you can put together subsets of lambda, you put it in a set, it's the power set. And then consider one particular subset of this power set. Let me call it E. For instance, in this drawing, I could say that whenever two points are linked by one of these guys, by one of the segments, they are in E. So you see that this represents a particular subset of all the possible subsets of the power set. So the pair lambda E is a graph. Okay. On a graph, you can define, so before I say that, in this case, as you can see, all the edges, I mean, all the elements of E contain two points. But this is not necessary, right? I could define a graph in this way. And I say that this is an edge, this is an edge, this is an edge. So far, I've been doing the same thing that I've done so far. This is an edge, contains three points. This is an edge. This is an edge, contains four points. The set of these subsets is E. And it's another graph. What is graph distance between A and B? Well, first of all, let me define what is a path from A to B. It is some collection of edges of L edges. So I goes from 1 to L, such that A is in the first edge, B is in the last edge, and two consecutive edges always intersect. Okay, so this is a path. And we call L of these choices of edges the length of this path. Okay, because it contains L edges. What is the distance between A and B? Well, there are many paths for going from A to B. And I call the distance between A and B the minimum over all the possible paths of the path distance. Okay. So now that I know how to measure distances on a graph, I want to know how to measure range of interactions in a Hamiltonian. So how do we do that? We do it in this way. We define what is called interaction map, phi. So what does phi do? Phi takes any subset in my set of points and associates an Hermitian operator on the bounded operators of the Hilbert space on X. Okay? So for instance, I take one subset of points. To these points corresponds a Hilbert space that is the tensor product of these local Hilbert spaces. And I associate an Hermitian operator onto this. And now I can ask the following properties. First of all, that this map is zero if the support of X is greater than R. Or if if this is X, the points, the distance at which the points can interact is larger than some number. So how do we call this? We call diameter of X, diam of X, simply the max over all the pair of points in X of the distance between X and Y. So we require that this would be zero also when the diameter of X is greater than R, small r. So you see, a local interaction is an Hermitian operator that contains at most capital R local Hilbert spaces, and that are, according to graph distance, at most the distance small r between each other. Then a local Hamiltonian, a local RR Hamiltonian, is just the sum of these operators. So this is what a local quantum system is. Questions?
What does the B mean again?
Oh, this is the set of Hermitian bounded operators on this Hilbert space, calligraphic B. Hermitian bounded operators.
What does it mean for them to be bounded again?
That the norm of the operator is finite. What is the norm of an operator? So what is the norm of an operator A? Well, what you do is that you consider all the possible. So first of all, you know what is the norm of this. Why? Because A times psi is what? Huh? It's a vector. Okay. So you know what's the norm of the vector because it's the inner product with itself. So you know what this is. And then you take the sup over all the psi's, let me say over all the normalized psi's, and this is what I call the norm of an operator. A bounded operator as infinite, sorry, as finite node.
When you say soup, do you just mean like, are you just taking the trace of A star A or A dagger?
That's another type of node.
Okay.
So this is the so-called operator node. So this is the strongest of all the norms that you can put on operators. Then there are so-called shut and P norms, and the trace is the one with P equal 1. Okay, so example, okay? So let's make a concrete example that will substantiate all this. The quantumizing model. This will be the model that we will discuss the most and that we learn how to solve exactly. So we have a Hilbert space that is the Hilbert space of n one-half spins. So this is the Hilbert space of one spin one-half. And then we take n times this product, and we use this notation for this tensor product. Now consider the following interaction map. So we have a graph that is only made of links. So you only have points and pairs, okay, in your graph. And your interaction map is such that when x is a point, we associate, what the notation I used? Phi x is, these are two numbers, and then I have the polymatrix x, sigma x, acting on the Hilbert space at I. And when x is one of the links of the graph, I associate phi x equal minus j sigma z on I tensor sigma z on j. So as you can see, this is an operator that is two local. This is an operator that is one local. This is an operator that has range 0. This is an operator that has range 1, because I and j are a distance 1, because there is one link between them. And so my Hamiltonian, being the sum of all these things, will be equal to the sum over all the sides of sigma x plus the sum over all the links in my graph of sigma z I tensor sigma z j. So this is the Hamiltonian of the quantumizing model in any space with n particles and when n spins one off. If this graph is a chain, so if it has this structure, then I can label all the links by I and I plus 1. And so this becomes the sum over I and I plus 1. But it doesn't need to be a chain. It can be any graph theoretic structure. OK, so having learned what is a local quantum system, tomorrow we'll start talking about what kind of object a phase could be in a local quantum system of very large n number of particles.